confusing me.
Jasper!
Dr. Phipps bellows from behind the wagon. Come here, son! Jasper rolls his eyes.
Duty calls. It has been a great pleasure, mademoiselle. We shall meet again.
He bows and takes a few steps before turning back to face me again.
A word to the wise, Clara dear. Hurry along to Mama and don't get into mischief.
His condescension irks me. I wish my manners did not prevent me from telling him that he is not half as appealing as he seems to believe he is. Instead, I lift the too long hem of the borrowed sari and walk like a well-mannered young lady in the direction he recommended. As I pass Jasper's tent, I am tempted to duck inside to visit O'Neill. Feeling disobedient and rather reckless, I give in to temptation and push my way through the tent flap.
Clara,
O'Neill says, seeing me before I see him. He is cocooned inside a hammock-like bed with only his head and arms free. Hush, I say, moving closer so that he might hear my whispers. I am forbidden to see Maren, and I did not ask permission to see you, so it might be best to keep quiet.
Why? Have you been causing trouble?
You know I have not. But that Dr. Phipps is a fearsome man, and his son is quite perplexing. They visited Landfair Mountain last spring, selling their sham cures. I do not trust them.
You worry too much, Clara. They saved us, did they not? Jasper risked his life getting us out of the burning caravan.
Yes, well, I would feel much better if I could see Maren, even for a few minutes.
You will see her soon, and we will return to the road in a day or two at most, whether this Dr. Phipps fellow approves or not. Although I am sorry to tell you, we will have to continue without Job and January. Jasper says they fled the fire, but I think they were stolen. They would not have run from me after all our adventures together.
He offers me his hand, and I notice that his arm is swathed in gauze.
We must not count our losses now. Not while Maren still needs our help.
Are they bad, your injuries? Against my better judgment, I place my hand in his. My heart beats faster than I wish it would.
My right leg is the worst. But it should be as good as gold in no time, thanks to Soraya's poultices.
I am glad you are improving, I say. I try to take my hand back, but his grip is firm. Please, I should go. I do not add that by holding my hand so sweetly, he makes me betray myself and Maren. He smiles his crooked smile, his eyes full of O'Neill mischief, and lets go.
As you wish,
he says. I do not say goodbye before scurrying out of the tent, tripping over the sari's hem as I exit. Such a jumble of feelings crowds my heart again. Uncertainty and impatience, love and disgust. Surely it would be easier to be a stork than a 17-year-old girl. Inside the speeding wagon, O'Neill and I sit on woven mats. Soraya reclines on an upholstered couch, snoring most daintily. Apparently she is unbothered by Dr. Phipps's wild driving. How he relentlessly urges the four horses onward with the crack of his whip and the lash of his tongue. Following in our dusty wake, Jasper drives the smaller wagon, the one loaded with the doctor's collection of wonders and rarities. According to Dr. Phipps, the mermaid is lucky to be traveling amongst such priceless treasures. I should remind him that she is not an object to be collected, but a beloved sister and friend. Yet I keep silent. Out of wisdom or cowardice, or perhaps a bit of both. Soraya, O'Neill, and I ride in the company of less exalted items. Labeled cases of medicines are neatly stacked along the walls beside trunks of various sizes. Costumes and musical instruments hang from pegs. One shelf holds a row of men's shoes and boots, and another displays a collection of ladies' slippers. Some leather, some satin, some spangled with crystals. Boxes and bottles of food crowd a few other shelves. Above my head, a huge burlap bag swings from a hook and rains down grains of rice, one at a time, from a tiny tear in its side. As rapidly as we cross the countryside, time seems to drag inside the wagon. In my mind, I relive Marin's transformation from her simple love of water to the first hint of scales upon her side. From discovering her fused together legs to beholding her brilliant tail fin. From her fading whispers to the sea on sand sound of her most recent laughter. From the wishing pool to the washtub and to whatever vessel she now inhabits. I miss her. I miss her as I'd miss my sight if I were suddenly blind. I miss her as a tree must miss its wealth of leaves come midwinter. I miss her continually, painfully. Through the open window, I see the shadow of a large bird hover and swoop. I know that bird, and it is no bird. It is Osbert. He is safe, and he is with us.
Worrying again, worry bird?
O'Neill asks, whispering so as not to disturb Soraya's slumber. I've just seen Osbert, I say. He is following us.
You see? No real harm can befall us while the wyvern watches. All is well. Other than my legs, that is.
I wonder if Soraya has dosed him with something. How could he believe all is well when Marin is hidden from us and possibly shrinking away?
We cannot afford to be waylaid, I say. We do not have time to help put on shows, no matter how beholden we may be to the Phipps family. We must not continue with them unless they agree to take us to the ocean. Marin's life is in the balance.
I will ask the doctor, O'Neill says. He does not frighten me with his shouting and lording.
Thank you.
A pillow tumbles off Soraya's couch and rolls within my reach. I take it and stuff it behind my back. Its softness, combined with Osbert's presence and O'Neill's promise, gives me a measure of comfort.
I will ask Dr. Phipps's leave for you to see Marin as well, he says. I know how much you miss her. All the sparkle has left your eyes.
Marin is the one who sparkles, I say. I change the subject. How does it feel to wear such fine clothes?
O'Neill is dressed in a blue silk shirt and a black vest and trousers pinstriped with yellow. Jasper's garments, obviously.
As usual, my trousers are 2 inches too short, he says, and this shirt smells of jasper and sandalwood.
What is it you children whisper of?
Soraya says. Her many bracelets jangle as she yawns and stretches her arms wide.
We have been friends since we were infants, O'Neill says. We talk of everything, and sometimes nothing at all.
Dr. Phipps does not approve of idle talk, Soraya says. He says that it weakens the soul.
Then I beg to differ with the doctor, O'Neill says. I find good conversation very energizing.
You would do well not to speak to the doctor of your opinions, young man. He does not take kindly to those who oppose him. In Dr. Phipps's show, he is king. He is never wrong.
Have you never disagreed with your husband?
O'Neill asks.
Soraya's eyes widen in horror.
Never! I see,
O'Neill says. He opens his mouth to continue, but I interrupt. I will not sit and watch him endanger himself by picking petty fights with Soraya. If the doctor is king, then she is queen, and O'Neill is dancing on dangerous ground. You should rest, I say to him, rather loudly. You are still recovering from your injuries, after all.
I am tired all of a sudden, he says.
Our eyes meet for a moment, and I believe he understands my unspoken plea for him to tread more carefully.
Sleep, Soraya says, for how will you repay your debts to us if you do not regain your strength? How much is it worth, the saving of a life? 12 performances? A whole season's shows? We shall let Dr. Phipps decide, yes?
I shudder, knowing such a debt can never be repaid. We are butterflies in a net, O'Neill, Marin, and I, and we must find a way to escape while Marin still lives. Chapter 18. The wagon rolls to a stop. Soraya's breaths are deep and even as she indulges in her third nap of the day. Through the window, I see small town buildings, their window panes reflecting the red and purple of the setting sun. Jasper opens the door and summons O'Neill and me with a gesture. I help O'Neill to his feet and let him lean on me as we make our way through the wagon. With his limping, it is difficult to be quiet. Yet we do not wake Soraya. At the door, Jasper takes over supporting O'Neill, helping him to the ground.
Papa Doctor has gone to procure a performance space, Jasper says. He'll have a drink or two before he comes back. Mama is obviously unconscious. So, now is your golden opportunity to see the mermaid.
Truly? I say. You will take us now? I could sing for joy at the thought of seeing Marin again.
This way, lady and gentlemen, Jasper says.
He leads us to the other wagon. After removing a padlock and chain, he opens the door.
Go ahead, Clara. I will help our gimpy friend.
The wagon is full of wooden boxes and strange shapes draped with lengths of gray cloth. Although the windows are open, the space is dark and dim. The air smells of dust, dried flowers, and old books. We barely have enough room to move among the objects. Jasper brushes past me and stands beside what appears to be a pillar covered with midnight blue velvet. He takes hold of one corner of the fabric and pulls it slowly, languidly, as though to build excitement in his little audience. Finally, the velvet slides down to form a dark pool around the base of the largest glass apothecary jar I have ever seen. 5 feet tall, pale green, and crowned with a fancifully wrought silver lid.
Behold the mermaid, Jasper says theatrically.
As if on cue, Marin opens her eyes. When she sees me, she presses her doll-sized hand to the glass and smiles. Her color is less ashen, pearlier than when last I saw her. Her skin has regained some of its shimmer. Her copper-gold hair floats about her head like a nimbus. I kneel beside the jar and place my hand against hers. The layer of glass between us warms slowly. I have missed you, sister, I say. Although I do not think she can hear me, she smiles wider and blows a kiss with her free hand. O'Neill lowers himself to the floor beside me. Marin's face lights up, and she flicks her tail prettily. I glance at his odd expression. Part fascination, part shock. It is then that I notice she has lost her wrappings and is bare-breasted. Good heavens, I say. Avert your eyes, O'Neill. I do not think he hears me, for he continues staring at her fluttering lashes, flashing scales, and unclothed torso. Jasper clutches his belly and doubles over with laughter. This is not at all amusing, I say, standing in an attempt to block the men's view of my sister.
You haven't seen much of the world, have you, my dear? Jasper says.
What does that matter? I scramble to throw the velvet cover over the jar. Morals and manners are not things to be left at home. Jasper laughs again, howling like a mad dog.
The mermaid's sister is a holy sister, he blurts once he catches his breath. And what are you, O'Neill? A priest, perhaps?
The velvet falls over the glass with a whisper. O'Neill says,
I am sorry, Clara.
His face is cherry red. Jasper smacks his thigh.
What fun we shall have! A straight-laced maiden, an innocent boy in love with a mermaid, and me, body heir apparent to the kingdom of Phipps.
This is not amusing, I say again. Please excuse me, I must find something for my sister to wear. I glare at Jasper until he takes a step back. When he motions for me to pass, I spy the scarlet tattoo on his wrist. The same charm against mermaid enchantment O'Neill wears. Jasper's mother's words echo in my mind.
I have dealt with her kind before, and I know what they must have, what elements will keep them alive outside the sea.
Now I am certain that Marin is not the first mermaid to be part of Phipps's vile show. A shiver runs up my spine. O'Neill follows me outside, limping and grimacing.
I turn to chide him as we walk back to the other wagon.
I cannot believe how you stared at her. Scarf would be ashamed of you.
He keeps his eyes trained on the ground.
I am truly sorry,
he says.
I behaved like a scoundrel. Will you forgive me?
I will try,
I say. But he has not just treaded upon my morals.
He has also bruised my heart, and bruises do not disappear instantly.
From the other wagon's doorway, Soraya watches us approach, hands on hips.
Where have you naughty children been?
She demands. Jasper puts an arm around my shoulders, startling me. I had not heard him approach.
They were with me, Mama. No need to worry.
I disagree. We have many reasons to worry, and Jasper and his mother are just two of them. If I could, I would wish O'Neill's legs healed so that we could take Marin and flee this very hour. Among the boxes and crates of medicines and soaps, I find a pile of cheaply made scarves. I choose one made of snow-white cambric and bordered with celery-colored lace. I detest stealing even such a little thing, but Marin must be clothed without delay. The men are busy pitching the tents. Soraya has gone to buy thread. The door to the wagon where Marin is kept stands wide open. I slip inside unnoticed. A single sunbeam touches the blue velvet covering the glass jar. Is she still alive? I wonder. What if she could wait no longer to go home? My blood runs cold. I force myself to pull the velvet away. There she is, my sister. She faces away from me, combing her fingers through her bright locks, oblivious to my presence, but alive. I try to lift the ornate lid straight up, but it does not budge. I crack my fingernails and bruise my palms, working to unscrew it. And as I am about to give up, the lid turns with a squeak. Three rotations later, I remove it and set it on the floor. Marin, come here, I say, peering down into the oily-looking liquid. It smells of cloves and sulfur and honeysuckle, plus a few things I cannot name. My sister ignores my request. She swims in lazy circles, her silvery green tail undulating and her glossy hair fluttering like a flag in a steady wind. Her bare torso reminds me of a painting of a Greek goddess from one of Auntie's art books. The goddess had the same alabaster skin and round breasts and seemed just as unbothered by her nakedness as Marin is. But although the goddess was beautiful, she could not compare to Marin. Somehow, despite the incongruity of her womanly mermaid shape and her child-sized body, she is beautiful beyond words.
Please come here, sister, I say, raising my voice. Hurry!
She swims to the top of the jar and pokes her head out of the water. When she sees the scarf, she must guess my intent. She pouts and shakes her head.
Please do this for me, I say. Even though you are not embarrassed, I am embarrassed for you. Imagine what Auntie would say after everything she taught us about modesty and virtue.
Marin raises her arms in surrender. I wrap the scarf about her chest and tie it in a double knot at the center of her back.
There,
I say.
It is rather fetching with the lace at the top like that.
She sticks out her tongue like a spoiled toddler and dives to the bottom of the jar. Her crossed arms and turned back are familiar to me. I have seen both 100 times during our lifetime of sibling squabbles. Her sulkiness does not bother me. In fact, it makes me glad. My sister may have a fish's tail, but her independent spirit is the same as it has always been. Goodbye, dearest, I say.
I will be back as soon as I can. Osbert is nearby, and so is O'Neill. And we will find a way to take you home soon.
She turns to face me. Bubbles float up from her lips as she mouths, O'Neill, and presses both hands over her heart. Then she motions again, and I know what she intends to say. Tell him that I love him.
Goodbye, I say again. I crown the jar with its lid and drape the velvet over it. I will deliver her message to O'Neill, but I wish I did not have to.
Chapter 19.
The camp stands like a foreign guest in a dandelion-studded field. The fabric of the two green tents moves in and out with the breeze as if they are breathing. The large wagon is parked in front of them and has been transformed by the attachment of a raised wooden platform into a stage complete with red velvet curtains and copper shell-shaped footlights. Queued in front of the stage, plank benches await the audience. A big red and yellow striped tent is situated to the right of the stage, a golden pennant snapping on its pole at the peak. The cloth sign above the door proclaims it the Gallery of Wonders. I have not seen this tent before. Phipps and company must not have pitched it when they visited Lanfair Village.
Grand, is it not?
Jasper says from behind me, startling me.
It is time for supper, Clara. The townspeople will begin to arrive soon.
He wraps his arm round my shoulders and steers me along.
Mama has prepared my favorite dish in honor of your joining the show.
I try to shrug off his arm, but he fights my efforts.
We do appreciate your kindness, but it is not possible for us to join your show. O'Neill and I must take Marin to the ocean. She will not survive much longer otherwise.
Even as the words leave my mouth, I regret them. I ought to have kept silent rather than revealing our plans to leave. I should have waited for O'Neill to speak to Dr. Phipps in his charming, persuasive O'Neill way. Although I suspect Phipps will deny his pleas. Why would he give up a prize such as Marin?
Nonsense, Jasper says. Marin is fine. The solution Mama concocted for her can keep her healthy for years. I have seen it done.
It is not what Marin wants, to live in a jar. It is not what is best for her.
And fretting like a wet hen is not what's best for you, Clara dear. It ruins a girl's looks. Now, relax and breathe in that heavenly aroma,
Jasper says, inhaling deeply.
The finest of spices combined to perfection.
We round a corner. Dr. Phipps beckons us to the campfire, where four mismatched wooden chairs and a stool with a tufted cushion have been arranged in a semicircle. O'Neill gives a little wave. I duck out from under Jasper's arm and hurry to sit beside him. Soraya dips her ladle into the depths of a cast-iron pot. She fills blue china bowls, and Jasper hands them around, serving his father first. Steam rises from each dish in deliciously fragranced curlicues. A brass tea kettle sits at the edge of the embers, hissing and spitting.
Eat, children,
Soraya says as she takes her seat. We eat with silver spoons, scooping up yellow rice, tender bits of meat, rabbit or maybe chicken, but not squirrel, surely. Sliced almonds and plump golden raisins, seasoned with an array of mysterious spices and herbs. With each bite, I miss Auntie more. She would be able to name every ingredient in the dish. During such a dinner, she would recount a story about the dish's origin. Perhaps something about a camel herder's homely daughter winning a nomadic prince's affections by way of her fine cooking. Marin has always loved such romantic tales. After we enjoy second helpings of rice, Soraya presses an earthenware mug into my hand and gives O'Neill its twin.
Drink, she says.
And so we do, moving in dance-like unison as we lift the mugs to our lips and sip the hot liquid. I taste honey, cinnamon, and black tea. And behind those pleasant flavors, a tang that hints of forbidden pleasures. My whole body warms and tingles as I drain the cup. Jasper rises with a strange, derisive snort and stalks away. Across from O'Neill and me, Soraya sits at her husband's feet and rests her head against his impeccably dressed knee. Dr. Phipps smiles, but not at her. He is smiling at O'Neill and me. And his smile is a wicked,
wicked thing.
O'Neill wipes his mouth on his sleeve.
What was in that?
He asks. He is trembling, his shoulder shuddering against mine.
Ah, dear boy, the devil does not share his receipt, and neither do I,
Dr. Phipps says.
I call it beloved bondage, for you shall crave it daily for the rest of your lives, needing it more than the air you breathe. And you shall be enslaved to the one who holds its secrets. That would be me.
The world seems to tip on its axis at this revelation, and I grab for O'Neill's arm as if he might prevent me from falling off. O'Neill lunges toward the doctor with raised fists.
You son of a— If you choose to hit me, I promise that you will be dead within the week,
Dr. Phipps says calmly. I look to Soraya for sympathy or outrage, hoping that she will object or demand that her husband grant us an antidote, or that she will laugh and spoil his dark joke. Instead, she runs her red tongue over her lips and nestles closer to her husband. Dr. Phipps takes a pocket watch from his vest and checks the hour.
It is time for you to change into your costume, Soraya, my love.
He leans over and kisses her noisily. And then, like a minotaur lifting a nymph, Dr. Phipps hoists his wife and clutches her to his chest. Humming, he waddles toward the tents.
Wash those dishes quickly, Clara, Soraya calls over his shoulder. You must not miss the show.
O'Neill and I run to the bushes, coughing and gagging, trying to purge ourselves of the foul liquid, but it refuses to leave us. Jasper emerges from the shadows like a ghost.
It's no use, he says.
He curses and tosses a stone into the fire.
I have asked him not to use that stuff anymore, but he never listens. Why can we not be a regular traveling show with willing performers? Why must he poison each friend I make?
He kicks the dirt with his fine leather shoe and curses again.
Help us, O'Neill begs. Get us the antidote and we can all escape together. You could get a job in the best circus in Europe if you wanted to. I have friends who could help you.
Jasper sighs.
Alas, I am as bound to them as you are, he says, and there is no antidote. If you do not drink daily, you die.
Jasper lifts his trouser leg to his knee. His calf is tattooed with blue scrawls.
These are the names of those who have gone before you. Those who have dared to try to escape my father and his tea. Those whose bodies I have been forced to bury or burn or send down rivers.
I cover my mouth. Even in moonlight, I can count 20 names.
Here,
he says, pointing at the largest name. It is near his knee, its letters formed from flowering vines.
Zara was my wife. Papa found her performing in Canada and paid a handsome sum for her. Her own father sold her to him. She could charm the birds from the trees with her violin. She could make fireflies swarm like gnats around her body as she played and danced. Zara was the most beautiful and clever girl I'd ever met. We fell in love, but not before Papa poisoned her with his terrible tea. I didn't know what it was then, and neither did she, for he had just invented it. She drank it happily each night after dinner, and we would whisper of our plans till dawn. One afternoon, while Papa and Mama were bartering with a farrier, Zara and I snuck off and found a judge to marry us. We did not tell my parents, fearing Papa's disapproval, but also relishing the grand romance of a secret marriage. Eventually, we were discovered. She died soon after, and whether it was due to our son's complicated stillbirths or Papa's wicked works, I do not know for certain. You are as evil as he is. You did nothing to stop us from drinking the poison, O'Neill says.
The venom in O'Neill's voice chills me. I open my mouth to speak, but find I cannot. I am too disturbed for words. I am thinking of my sister, our bondage.
and how badly things have turned so quickly. That what seemed like rescue led to entrapment.
Ah, Jasper says, what you do not know is that Papa gave me the tea on the same night he gave it to Zara. He has held my life hostage since. I do not dare oppose him. And even if I were to threaten his life, he would not tell me his secrets. Did you try? When you found that he had poisoned your wife, did you even try to force him to tell you?
O'Neill asks. Or were you too cowardly to stand up to him?
I did try, Jasper says. The night I lit the funeral pyre for Zara and our son, I held a knife to his throat. My hand shook so badly that I nicked him. He hides the scar beneath his cravat. He only laughed at my threats. He dared me to kill him. Said I'd join him in death within 2 days without his secret potion. So you see, there is nothing you can do but obey him, as I do.
You have no hope of escape, I whisper. We have no hope of escape.
His mouth curves in an unconvincing smile.
Well, it is not such a bad life. We travel. We sow moments of rapture, and we reap applause and money. We are adored like gods by the bored housewives and frustrated farmers we entertain.
He recites these words as if reading lines from a play.
It is not such a bad life at all.
O'Neill sneers.
Except you cannot leave it for another life of your choosing.
Jasper shrugs. His face is like a mask, emotionless. Has he been enslaved so long that it seems normal to him? Unremarkable?
I wish for nothing but the life I have with the show,
he says. Wishing gets you nothing, I say.
That is the truth, Jasper says. Why despair over things we cannot change? And I predict that we shall have some grand adventures together on the road. But what of Marin?
O'Neill asks. She will perish if she is not taken to the ocean soon.
She may well outlive us all, Jasper says, and she looks quite happy in that jar of hers. I half envy her simple, easy life.
He wanders back to the fire and pokes it with a long stick. Sparks fly heavenward, and he watches them rise and then flicker out.
Well, what is done, and what shall be is yet to be, and I must change into my costume. Clean up here and then go backstage. You can watch the show from there.
He saunters off. I cannot decide whether I pity Jasper or hate him. Could he have saved O'Neill and me from bondage? Or would it have cost him his life? And what would I have done in his place? His story is not my own. I do not know its complexities and what lurks in its corners, and so I cannot say. Perhaps if he had spoken out against his father tonight, Soraya would be laying the three of us out upon a funeral pyre now, right here beneath the rising crescent moon. O'Neill limps back to a chair by the fire. He sits, head in hands, his suffering obvious. But how can I help him? I have neither balms nor elixirs to heal his body, nor do I have any words of cheer to displace his despair. Soraya has left me a kettle of hot water, a rag, and a basin for washing the dishes. I scrub them hard, taking out my frustrations upon every bowl and spoon. Not sure what to do with them next, I pile the clean dishes on the chairs near the fire. When I go to empty the basin in the bushes, a beady eye glints up at me. The eye is set in a plumed black head that rests, disembodied, atop a pile of dark feathers. The sheen of these plucked feathers is familiar to me. That poor bird was not just any bird. I am sick to my very soul. We have eaten our dear friend Pilsner for supper. I do not want to watch the show. I want to take Marin's jar and steal a horse and ride to the Atlantic as fast as I can. I want O'Neill to go with me.
I want Meryn to be safe and well in her ocean home, and I want to go home to Lanfair Mountain and Auntie. Wanting is as bad as wishing, I suppose, if the one who wants does nothing, or can do nothing. I find O'Neill backstage. He is staring into the distance. His face is pale, his forehead creased with concern.
They served us Pilsner for supper, I blurt.
I could not keep myself from telling him. I shiver as I remember finding the raven's pretty head. I sit on an overturned wooden box and try not to give way to tears. Could I ever stop weeping if I allowed myself to begin now? Could the ocean contain such a flood? Beside me, O'Neill is perched on a wooden stool, his right leg propped on a box. When I sniffle, he hands me a handkerchief. He rests his cool hand on the back of my neck.
Pilsner was a good friend. I am sorry for your loss. For our loss,
he says.
It is no use being sorry, I say. Will we do nothing about it? Will you accept his death as easily as you have accepted our Meryn being put on display and ogled?
The words spill out, laced with poison like Phipps's tea.
Have you forgotten your promise to protect my sister and me? After all your time with magical gypsies, have you no idea how to escape the curse of the doctor's tea? Perhaps if you kill the owner of the curse will be broken.
My whole body pulses with the pounding of my heart. Did I truly just ask O'Neill to commit murder? He removes his hand from my neck.
How can you hold me accountable for the Phipps's treachery? It is unfair, Clara.
And do you think that I have not considered every possible solution to our problems? Not for one minute have I forgotten my promises to you. But Scarf spent years teaching me to overcome my natural impulse to act rashly, and I will not risk our lives by rushing to revenge. Forgive me. I feel as if I am coming apart at the seams. Maybe it is the tea's fault. Or perhaps I am changing into my true self as Meryn did, only my true self is neither girl nor stork, but an ugly, mean thing. A troll or a harpy.
You do not believe that, he says gently. You are hurt and afraid and losing hope. Be hurt and afraid if you must, and grieve for poor Pilsner. But do not lose hope. Wouldn't Auntie give you this same advice, my dear?
I stare at the floor.
Yes,
I say, ashamed. O'Neill tucks a handkerchief into my clenched palm, and I use it to dab the tears that have somehow seeped from my eyes.
But you know what they are up to, do you not? Meryn is to be the main attraction in the Gallery of Wonders. They will drag her about the country and show her off until their pockets are overflowing, and she dies from being kept in a jar. She is not the first mermaid they have used in such a way. Jasper wears the same tattoo as you. And you and I will be their slaves until they tire of us, and in the end, Jasper will add our names to his list.
On the other side of the red velvet curtain, the audience talks and laughs, growing louder as more voices join in. They are excited, glad for the free entertainment. Would they be so happy if they knew the utter depravity of the Phipps family?
Look,
O'Neill says, his face turned skyward. Osbert swoops low. His blue-scaled body almost invisible against the late afternoon sky.
Our faithful wyvern guardian angel,
O'Neill says.
Reason enough to hope a little, don't you think?
Dr. Phipps climbs the steps on the opposite end of the platform and joins us backstage.
Quiet now, he says. The show is about to begin.
He walks to the place where the curtains meet and signals for them to be opened. To the side, I see Jasper pull the ropes, causing the curtains to slide apart with a whoosh. Dr. Phipps steps forward and the crowd is instantly silent.
Ladies and gentlemen, he proclaims, I, Dr. George Wilhelm Hieronymus Lewis Balthazar Phipps,
Welcome, one and all, to this, our astounding and spectacular entertainment. Prepare to be amazed!
The crowd applauds. Dr. Phipps removes his hat and bows low for a count of three. Once upright again, he extends his arms and says,
I present to you the toast of the crowned heads of Europe and Asia, the beautiful chanteuse, Madame Soraya of Gojanastani.
Soraya sweeps onto the stage in a sparkling gown of sunset-colored silk and a veil as sheer as candlelight. Phipps takes her hand. She curtsies low, and then he leaves her. I did not expect the stage to be so beautiful from this vantage point. Strings of brass lanterns hang above the platform, and with the footlights they cast a golden glow upon the doctor's wife. She begins to sing. The song is strange, its notes sliding and curving. Its lyrics poignant to me, even though I do not know one word of the language. Her soprano voice climbs the scale and holds a note more piercing than any I have ever heard.
Glass would break, O'Neill says, if she sang one note higher.
A moment later, she ends the song with a flourish of her bracelet-covered arm. Applause erupts from the audience. Soraya curtsies several times before stepping behind the curtain's edge. She comes close to us, saying,
That is how you enchant these small-town peasants. Tomorrow night, Nilo, you will perform and know the love of the crowd, the delicious devotion of strangers.
Her smile, I imagine, would not look out of place on a crocodile with a belly full of fresh antelope. Her jewelry jingles as she descends from the platform and heads toward her tent. Jasper takes the stage, carrying his violin and a wooden stool. He makes a show of flinging the tails of his finely tailored green coat out of the way before he sits. A hush falls over the audience as he tucks the violin beneath his chin. He begins to play a slow melody, the essence of a lazy summer afternoon. He taps one foot to the beat, and the tapping grows faster as one song leads into the next. Soon, all but the feeblest spectators are on their feet, dancing and jumping and clapping. He stands and bows. The people clamor for another song. He obliges them, choosing a tune as sweet and light as bird song. Dr. Phipps walks to Jasper's side, raising both arms in a grand gesture.
The great Jasper Armand shall entertain you again momentarily,
he says.
First, I must deliver unto you a message of the greatest import. As a practitioner of the medical arts, I am bound by conscience to speak to you plainly, to reveal the deep secrets of healing I have gathered. Open your ears to the sound of my voice, ladies and gentlemen.
Jasper carries his instruments off stage as his father continues to speak. He winks at me as he breezes by. Dr. Phipps's speech is almost identical to the one he gave last spring on Landfair Mountain. I exchange a look with O'Neill. The doctor's claim to want to heal and help all mankind does not sit well with those of us who have been drugged and deceived by him. Half an hour later, Jasper plays a Pied Piper song on a pan flute as the townsfolk move in a mesmerized herd toward the sales tables.
Amazing,
O'Neill says. Disgusting, I reply. Dr. Phipps is evil incarnate.
Yes. Evil and charismatic, a most dangerous combination.
O'Neill gets to his feet.
I have seen enough.
The music stops as Dr. Phipps returns to the stage.
Attention! Attention! I regret that I failed to invite you, one and all, to visit the large tent situated behind the stage. It is no ordinary tent, but our gallery of wonders. A mere 5 cents will gain you access to our collection of the unusual, the bizarre, and the outrageous. Wonders such as you could not imagine. Seize this opportunity by the horns, folks, or you will live with the weight of regret forever.
Form a line at the door, and the famous Jasper Armand shall soon usher you in to view the secrets and curiosities of the ages.
A pang of sorrow pierces my heart.
Marin,
I whisper.
They will see her, stare at her.
Come,
O'Neill says, taking my hand.
There is nothing we can do now. He's right,
Dr. Phipps says, startling us by poking his bewhiskered face between us.
Go to your beds, children, and do not delay. I will not have you hatching any silly plans, which would only hasten your deaths, I might add. And neither do I permit any romantic nonsense among my company. Consider yourselves forewarned on both counts. Go on, to your beds.
As I approach my tent, I hear a rustling in a nearby tree. I look up. Two glowing eyes peer down from among the leaves. Wyvern eyes. I blow a kiss to Osbert. I wish that I could invite him inside for the night. I would gladly share my pillow with him and let him drool upon it. I wish, for the first time in my life, that Osbert was a much bigger wyvern. One that could breathe fire on the terrible medicine show and then take to the sky while carrying Marin, O'Neill, and me on his back. Such a wyvern could carry us all the way to the ocean and then home again to Lanfair Mountain. But like magic, wyverns are rare in the world. Indeed, Osbert could be the last of his kind. And what good is rescue or escape if it only ends in our dying for want of Dr. Phipps's tea?
Chapter 20. The next morning, Dr. Phipps goes to town for a shave and haircut. Soraya retires for her mid-morning nap, and Jasper slinks off dressed in fine clothes and reeking of eau de cologne. Most likely to seduce some silly farm girl or faithless wife. I finish scrubbing the pans and dishes from breakfast and then take a seat beside the dying fire. I close my eyes for a moment and imagine what Auntie might be doing now. Is she weeding her gardens or mixing up remedies for fevers? Is she delivering Hattie Benfer's yearly baby? Or is she resting on the bench by the front door? Enjoying the sunshine and a cup of tea with her long-missed husband. A poke in the ribs makes me gasp. O'Neill, you should not sneak up on a lady like that, I say. I smack his arm hard.
Ladies should not be so violent, he says. I finished mending the harnesses. Where is everyone?
The men have gone to town. Soraya is asleep. Osbert is watching from the white pine above the gallery tent. He grabs my arm.
Come,
he says.
We may not have another chance soon.
Where are you taking me?
Do you need to ask?
Despite his limp, he pulls me along briskly, not stopping until we are inside the Gallery of Wonders. The place is dark and smells of old wood, musty books, and lamp oil. O'Neill finds a lantern and matches on the table just inside the door.
She should be near the back. I heard Jasper say something about a special mermaid viewing area,
O'Neill says. I follow him past tables of taxidermied animals and birds, strange things floating in jars, wooden masks and spears, artifacts enclosed in glass boxes. Finally, he pushes aside a thick gold curtain to reveal a raised platform and a glass apothecary jar containing a mermaid. I tap on the glass. Marin, I say, wake up, dear. We have come to pay you a visit. She turns toward us with a swish. When she sees O'Neill, she bats her eyelashes and wriggles her hips so that her scales shimmer in the lantern light. She combs her fingers through her coppery hair so it floats loose about her head. She flicks her tail, flaunting her mermaidness as if O'Neill is a sailor she wishes to bring to ruin. He turns away. His expression pained. His tattoo protects him from being utterly destroyed by her, but I know it does not save him from heartache or spare him from the normal desires of a young man. Marin, it is not nice to tease O'Neill like that. It's crude and unfair to him, I scold. She sticks out her tongue at me and then swims a few swift laps. It must be the liquid Soraya put her in, I say. She is quite out of hand. O'Neill keeps his back to Marin.
We should go,
he says. Her locket is gone, I say. The one you gave her for Christmas. She treasured it so.
Stolen by Soraya, no doubt, O'Neill says. Say your goodbyes, Clara, before we are missed.
I press my hand against the glass. Goodbye, sister, I say. Keep well, and do try to remember your manners. Marin stops swimming and places her hand in line with mine. From each of her sea-colored eyes falls a single pearl tear. And then she motions with her hands, asking, When will I go to the ocean? She is not happy after all.
I do not know, I say. We are trying to figure that out.
She motions again, telling of her love for O'Neill.
We know that you love us, dear, I say.
I will not repeat her exact sentiment to him. He has had enough torture for one day.
We love you too, but we must go now.
O'Neill and I do not speak again until we are outside.
Thank you, I say. I know how difficult that was for you.
Yes, well...
You are a good brother, I say. The very best.
At the sound of approaching footsteps, he turns his head.
Phipps is coming, he says. We must not be seen together.
I watch his back as he takes pained steps toward his tent, his shoulders slumped in a very un-O'Neill kind of way. While O'Neill and Jasper spend the afternoon rehearsing magic tricks and juggling, I wash clothes in a nearby creek and gather greens for an early dinner, all the while thinking about the poisoned tea. Does it make me think such thoughts, or are they a product of my own fears and frustrations? From time to time, Dr. Phipps's voice rings through the air.
Throw them higher, boy! And smile! What good is a morose juggler, I ask you?
Perhaps if you had not poisoned us, I would like to say to him, then we might work more joyfully for you. Perhaps if you would help us deliver Marin to the sea, we would perform feats that would astound even you. Soraya beckons me to the large wagon and commands that I remove my clothes down to the thin chemise she gave me after the fire. Horrified at the affront to my modesty, I blush from head to toe. Soraya titters like a small bird and holds forth a garment of heavy silk the color of celery, patterned with pink flowers and brown branches.
This is a kimono, she says. In it, you will be a Japanese princess.
My arms slip into the rectangular sleeves like Marin gliding through water. Just beneath my breasts, Soraya ties long, ribbon-like strips around the kimono, stuffing the fabric one way, tugging another. As though she has dressed 100 Japanese girls this week, she deftly wraps a wide band of pale blue around my ribs and whips its ends into a perfect bow.
There, she says, looking pleased with her work. Now close your eyes.
She rubs something cool and slick onto my face and paints my lips and eyelids with a damp brush. Finally, she tells me to open my eyes. She dips a tiny brush into a little pot of black paste and outlines my eyelids. Then she uses her nimble fingers to gather my hair into a knot at the back of my head. My curiosity gets the better of me, and I break the vow I made to myself not to speak to Soraya unless absolutely necessary. I ask,
Why are you doing this?
You must earn your keep, and performing is pleasure as well as work. Here is your chance to create art, to be art. You should thank me.
She reaches into a box and pulls out a stiff-looking wig the color of Pilsner's feathers. She arranges it over my hair. It is heavy and smells of cedar and candle wax.
Beautiful,
she says, looking me over from top to toe.
Tonight you will be part of our gallery of wonders. Our patrons will worship your loveliness. You will stand between the stuffed tiger cub and the African masks. I will ask Jasper to place a crate there for you to make you a little stage of your very own. Am I to stand there like a statue? This is your role. You play Hatsumi, a princess who has escaped her evil stepmother's house. You meet no one's eyes. You do not speak. You stare at the floor and count sorrows of your life. Soraya smiles and tucks a stray hair under the wig. The patrons will weep for you, poor lost flower of the Orient. Counting my sorrows should not be a problem, I think. But I will do this for Marin. To be near her for a few hours, to keep peace with our captors while O'Neill and I plot our escape. Soraya smooths the silken fabric of her sky-blue sari.
Someday, if you prove to Dr. Phipps that you can sing or dance or play an instrument, you might share the stage with Jasper and Nilo. For now, you are Hatsumi.
She sets a pair of odd wooden sandals on the floor and takes my hands, helping me step into them.
You need your special tea. And then you must take your place in the gallery before our patrons begin to arrive. For them to see you outside would be unlucky, like a man seeing his bride before the wedding.
She points to the door.
Hurry now, Hatsumi, to your tea. You are longing for it, are you not? Wanting it as a bee wants nectar or a leech craves blood?
When she smiles with all her teeth showing, she reminds me of a winter graveyard with two neat rows of snowy headstones. As I wait inside the Gallery of Wonders tent, I can hear Dr. Phipps starting the show. He welcomes the townsfolk to the second night of performances, thanks them for their hospitality, praises their wisdom in purchasing his wares the previous night. Violin music floats through the air. I imagine it is Jasper who is playing. Whoever the musician may be, the song is beautiful and haunting. As Soraya foretold, an overturned